Our guest this afternoon on Those Were the Days is the man who was voted the top TV and radio announcer in the United States for some 15 consecutive years by the public, by Radio Guide, which was the leading radio publication in the country, by Fame Magazine, and by the National Press. He's a man who was for 35 years the announcer on the Jack Benny program on radio and television.
Currently, we're a little light, folks. Good night.
That's it. That's the voice of Don Wilson. Now, Don, you never said that, really, did you?
No.
It was always Jack Benny who
said
that.
That's right. That's right.
He's also a man, obviously, who blushes at a long introduction, right?
Indeed.
Now, you're in town because you're appearing with the big broadcast of 1944.
Oh, it's a great show. It's the biggest show bargain in town. There's no question about it. It's been a very successful operation, and it's highly professional. People just love and adore the show. People come to me in the dressing room or outside the theater and said, it was so short, we'd stay another 2 hours. Give us more. This is what they'd like to have. So it's been accepted with open hearts and arms.
Well, it's a terrific show. It's at the Mill Run Theater through Sunday, the 15th of June, and you're the announcer, which is, what, is typecasting?
Perhaps you might
Perhaps
call
typecasting.
It that. Yeah.
They wanted to get an announcer for the big broadcast in 1944. Who else but Don Wilson? But
well, there's a great cast involved. Harry James and his great band backstop the whole show, mm-hmm. as you probably know. Dennis Day, a former member of the Benny Troupe, is on the show and does a great job. Dennis has developed into a great showman, and he sings a great Irish song as well as others, and he has a wealth of Irish stories that regale you. He doesn't have time to tell them all at any one time, but he's a great little guy and does a superb job. Fran Warren, whom I think you met at the hotel just as you were coming in, Fran is a great singer of songs. She was with Claude Thornhill for a number of years and made hit records under his tutelage. And there's Warren Covington and the Pied Pipers, who are on early in the show, and they do spot vignettes during the show. And they get the show off to a great, great start. They're so capable and do such a magnificent job. I'm sure you've heard their records many times and have played them.
The Pied Pipers, after
all. Oh, yes, indeed. And then, of course, there's one person we're going to miss a great deal in one sense, who's been with us up until this stand here, is Gordon McRae, who sings up Storm every time he mm-hmm. comes on the air. Very, very popular. Gordon's not with us now. However, I am told that Carmen Cavallaro will be with us in this engagement here. And Carmen and I were friends back in the early radio days in New York when I went back there in 1933, and we hadn't seen one another till he made a guest appearance on this show, the big broadcast of 44, a few months ago, and he's a showstopper, no question about it. He ties things up in great style. But all in all, there are eight of us involved, all highly professional people. And the delightful thing about this is, usually in a theatrical troupe of any number, you will find petty jealousies creeping in, and discontent rears its ugly head. There's not one bit of that in this troupe, because everybody knows their trade so very, very well, and do it so professionally, that there's no reason for any jealousy. They all have their own thing that they do, and they do it superbly. So it's nice to have that kind of an association with an operation of that kind.
You didn't mention the Ink Spots or the incomparable Hildegard.
Well, I hadn't gotten to there yet. Hildegard is an amazing gal. I'm going to have to pass on the Ink Spots, momentarily at least, because I understand they're not with us during this stand here at the Mill Run Theater.
Oh, really?
I see.
Oh,
that's a change
of pace then. Okay.
Well, changes are made overnight sometimes.
Sure.
So don't take that as a fact for me, because it may not be true. It's just rumor that I've heard. But getting back to Hildegard, Hildegard is one of the most amazing people I think I've ever known. She's 74 years old. She had a birthday here not too many weeks ago while we were on the road. And she looks the same. She's still does her act in the same mode and manner that she did for so many, many years and plays piano with her gloves on. And her trademark is so well established by that motif. And people just love her. But that's true with anybody that is in this particular cast of this show. It's the greatest show value that you can possibly get. Chicago, I hope you're listening, because
they're listening.
It's very true.
Yeah, it's a great show. The big broadcast of 44 at the Mill Run Theater through Sunday, and there's two shows on Sunday.
Got it?
At Sunday the 15th of June.
At the Mill Run Theater. I was over there this afternoon. Mm-hmm. The theater and around here is a delightful place. And I've had a little experience in the round, not a great deal. But it's an interesting technique that is used in the round, mm-hmm. rather than in the proscenium theater. And it's great to have the audience in such close proximity to you.
You got to hang on, though, so you don't fall off. We'd like to take the career of Don Wilson and talk a little bit about it this afternoon. Before you got into radio, which goes back to about when, 1920, we don't want to say?
Well, I don't mind saying it, 23.
1923.
Crystal set days.
Crystal set.
You wouldn't know anything about that, or would you, I think. But I remember the first radio set that I ever made myself was made out of an oatmeal box with a coil of copper wire, a galena, a cat's whisker, and an earphone, a set of earphones like we're wearing right now.
Yes.
And if you were lucky, your signal was heard six blocks down the piece. But that's the way it all started, in that very embryonic, early fashion, developed there to the battery-operated sets, and then, of course, to the Atwater Kents and all the others that came on the market as electrical sets.
It's a cliche now, but were you bitten by the radio bug as you listened with that headset from the Crystal set? In those early days?
It was intriguing. I was terribly intrigued with it. I got into it, if I may be just a little personal right now. I was a serious student of serious music during my days in high school and college. My high school days and all the elementary educational days were spent in Denver. I went to the University of Colorado at Boulder, Colorado. But I was a serious student of serious music, and I used to try to sing a little bit. Well, they finally found me out after I got into this thing called radio, and I had to drop out on the singing, but they permitted me to yak. So I've been talking ever since. Can't carry a tune in a basket.
Well, you were part of a trio.
Yes.
Back in the Denver area, right?
Well, may I brag a little? It was a very successful operation that we had. We were all in business in Denver, and I'd been studying with a very well-known coach in Denver, and I didn't know it at the time, but the other two boys in the trio were doing the same thing. And it was the coach in Denver who suggested, the vocal coach in Denver who suggested, because they had lost their lead voice, that they might like to talk to me. She thought perhaps I was a likely prospect. And so I joined them, and we were busier than bird dogs.
Mm-hmm.
We made a lot more money in radio, even in those days, and the extracurricular things that we did, and appearances of all kinds, including fill-ins at the Orpheum Theater, which was whenever an act couldn't appear, and why the trio would be engaged to play a week here and a week there. Now,
did you have a name?
Yes, we had a name. It was originally the Columbian Trio, and then that was changed to the Civitan Trio when we all became members of the Civitan Club, a service club like Rotary and Kiwanis and the rest of them. And then one of the commercial accounts that we had about 1925 in Denver was for the Piggly Wiggly Stores, and we became the Piggly Wiggly Trio. Then the trio decided they would migrate to the land of milk and honey, to California. So the vice president and manager of the Piggly Wiggly Denver unit was the owner of the San Francisco unit. So he put us under contract. We went into San Francisco. And the manager in the San Francisco unit sold us to Fanchon and Marco, which was the leading presentation house on the Pacific Coast at that time. And we'd open up, as we did, on Market Street at the big theater in San Francisco, and then we played the surrounding communities wherever Piggly Wiggly had an outlet.
And were you doing a little bit of radio at the same time?
Yes,
then?
And we were appearing on radio as the Piggly Wiggly Trio. It didn't cost the station, KFRC, the Don Lee outlet in San Francisco at that time. It didn't cost them anything for the talent because Piggly Wiggly was underwriting it. But Piggly Wiggly always got credit where we're on as a trio, a duo, or a single. Mm-hmm. And that was an exchange of services basis, you see.
What was radio like? Take advantage of a man now who was in radio back in the middle 20s. What was it like? What were the radio stations like in the first decade of radio broadcasting?
Well, by the time I'm referring to now, during the Piggly Wiggly days, some of the transmitters had become quite sophisticated and were doing a great job. The big problem was programming. For instance, when General Electric came into Denver and built KOA, which became one of the really high-powered giants in the business, you could only use music that was in public domain. So Genie with the light brown hair got quartered and sawed in a million different pieces all the time by anybody that went on KOA's air. So it was interesting. You opened up in the morning and swept out, and you appeared on the air, and you wrote shows, you produced shows, and appeared all during the day in the whatever particular facet of the radio activity of that station was doing at that time. This was KHJ, I'm speaking, referring to now, in Los Angeles. And anyway, it was a lot of fun growing up and trying to grow up in the radio business. It's such a great industry to be associated with. And to have the privilege of starting in the embryonic form, as radio was, relatively speaking, in those days, and trying to grow up with it, and to make the transition from radio about 1949 or 50 into television, and to try and grow up and become abreast of things in that monstrous media today, has been a liberal education, and I so often feel that the longer I'm in it, the less I know about it.
What was your very first job in radio after the singing thing ended, or didn't it just end and one end and the other begin?
Well,
as an announcer, I know you were a sportscaster.
Yes. I wound up on the Rose Bowl for several years. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether you're familiar with that or not. When McNamee no longer came out for the network, KFI being the flagship station in Los Angeles, originated games on the Pacific Coast for the NBC West Coast division. And I was involved in that, and that got me into the Rose Bowl. And I did the Rose Bowl for about 5 years. McNamee no longer came out, and I inherited the play-by-play. I'd had a little experience in football in high school and college, so... Mm-hmm.
Well, was that the beginning of your radio work as an announcer or sportscaster?
Yes, virtually. It really was. I'd done a little bit prior to that, but not anything of any great importance at that time, but it was the lucky niche that I fell into. And then NBC, as a result of the exposure on the Rose Bowl game for several years, NBC New York hired me as their sports announcer in the New York division, and I went east in 1933 to fulfill that commitment. Benny picked me up in the spring of 34.
Yeah. Well, I know that you, between 1929 and 33, you and Ted Husing were the two top sports announcers.
Ted Husing was the greatest sportscaster in the business, bar none. I knew Ted. I got to know him very, very well. And he was invaluable help to me. I was told by the boys at NBC, look out for Husing. He's high and mighty and sits in a little white castle all his own, won't talk to you. Ted and I met at Soldier's Field in Chicago. I had been sent back from New York the second week I was on the staff at NBC to do a Northwestern Stanford game. And I was standing back of a revetment in the stadium there at Soldier's Field, trying to stay out of that cold wind off of Lake Michigan. Here I am in a West Coast overcoat, which wouldn't be a lightweight top coat back in this country when the wind from Lake Michigan hits you. And a car came in, drove around the track, and a head came out the right-hand front one and said, don't you want to come over and get out of the wind? So I hightailed it over and sat in the back seat, and I looked at the chap back of the wheel. And I said, "Aren't you Ted Husing?" He said, "Yes, I am. And you're Don Wilson, aren't you?" And we met at that particular time and under those circumstances. And Ted was instantly the exact antithesis of what he'd been described to me. He was the most generous man that you've ever known about in your life, and he was the most knowledgeable. He said, "If I can help you in any way, Don, don't hesitate to call me. I'll be happy to. If we're on the same game, I'll come to your room, and I'll go over the scouting charts with you." Well, that's exactly what Ted did, and he was a great, great help. He was the greatest sportscaster in the business, in my book, in anybody's league.
Sounds like a little bit of admiration right there.
Oh, I'll never forget it.
When you were in New York doing sports, Jack Benny had been starting on radio. His first bit with radio was with Ed Sullivan, and a few months after that, he got his own show for Canada Dry, and then
that's
was on
right.
the air for
Canada Dry Beverages he was on for. Yeah. That was his first year as the Jack Benny Show.
Right.
Then the second year, he was signed by Chevrolet.
Mm-hmm.
And the contract was terminated at the end of 26 weeks. Now, so the story goes, and I think it's an awfully good story, but I won't vouch for its veracity, that the advertising manager of the Chevrolet division of General Motors concluded that their product was so high class that they should be represented on the air by a symphony and not by a comedian. So Jack's contract was terminated at the end of 26 weeks. And it was at that point in the spring of 1934 that he held an audition for an announcer to carry on with him for the rest of that season of 13 weeks. And I just got awfully lucky and got the job. I was thrown into a general audition with all the other stock boys and the freelance men around town. And the only answer I can give, how did it happen? Nothing really dramatic about it. Nothing world-shattering took place, except I think perhaps I laughed in the right places when I read lines, and that got me the job.
Well, had you when you had the opportunity to go in for this audition, in your mind, now you're pretty successful as a sportscaster at that time, did you think that this was a positive thing for you to become an announcer? I know Jack Benny was pretty big in radio at that time yet, but still.
I really didn't know enough about what I was trying to do or what was going on to be able to make any kind of a deduction. But it didn't take me long to realize that it was the happiest move that I would ever have the opportunity of taking advantage of, and I snapped at it.
Well, we're glad you did, too, because for so many years we had some tremendous good entertainment. You were preceded on the Benny Show by three other announcers, however.
And, maybe you remember who they were.
I did some digging to find out that George Hicks. Jack's first announcer.
Very good friend of mine.
And Paul Douglas, who later became an actor.
That's right, Paul was.
And a man
with
an exotic name by the name of Alois Avrila.
Avrila.
Yeah.
Alois Avrila was a Czech, one of the top people at NBC, and he was on, but he couldn't make the transition when that 26 weeks changeover took place that I referred to, because Avrila was doing the Firestone Hour, and General Tires brought Jack Benny for 13 weeks to fill out that 34 season. And so that's the reason that Jack was looking for another announcer.
So your first commercial for Jack was General Tires?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
That's right.
And then
Bill O'Neill, president of General Tires, was the man responsible for hiring Jack.
When you started to work for Jack, were you hired by the network or by the agency?
I was on staff at NBC, as everybody on the announcing staff had to be. I was under their management. But Jack was the man that did the hiring.
He
negotiated the whole deal.
Did he set your salary then at that time?
Well, I guess you would say he did. Jack had such a reputation of being a skinflint. And all I can say is that the Jack Benny that I knew had all the great attributes of a great human being, such as generosity, tolerance, interest, and he was back of you 100%. So I wasn't the, as time went on, I wasn't the recipient of his penuriousness, if it was so reputed to be on the air.
Yet over the course of time on radio and even into television, a lot of the great, of course, this is Jack's character coming out in the shows, but in so many instances, there was so many stories around Don Wilson's salary, which was next to nothing, and how he locked you in a room until it was time for you to sign, you know, until you would sign the new contract at the salary. And all of that sort of thing.
You have a great memory. You've done a lot of homework, haven't you?
Well, I enjoy listening to all those old shows and enjoy remembering them, too. You know.
Well, they were great, great days.
They were fantastic.
And the big broadcast of 1944 that we're doing here at the Mill Run is reminiscent of that great era, in the golden era of radio, in which I was fortunate enough to be a part of and be a part of the Benny operation in the doing.
In the big broadcast, you come out at the top of the show to warm up the audience. Is that correct?
That's right.
Now, you had the same role for the Benny show over
That's
the
right.
years.
Then I sort of emcee the show. I introduce all the acts as they come on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Harry James, of course, is the top star. He does a certain amount of introducing at the end of the show. But I might mention in passing, and I'm bouncing around sort of hither, thither, and yon, Harry and I did the Chesterfield show together in 1942. I did the Chesterfield show with Glenn Miller. Then when Miller went into the service, Harry took over, and I continued on. So Harry and I worked for Chesterfield at that time, and we haven't worked together in all these many years since, until the institution of the big broadcast of 1944. Excuse me.
You worked for Chesterfield's then while you were doing the Jell-O stuff for Jack.
Yes.
And then we forgot about Chesterfield's when you moved over to Lucky Strike.
Well, we were out for General Foods and Jell-O for 10 years, and Lucky Strike came after then. Lucky Strike sponsored Jack and the Benny Show for 15 years. They were the greatest longevity of any client on the show. General Foods being 10 years for Jell-O and 15 years for Lucky Strike.
It's amazing. You think back, Jack Benny had as his sponsor Jell-O for 10 years, and Lucky Strike for 15 years. And today, now here in the 1980s, you're lucky if you get a sponsor to pick up a 30-second commercial during a television special.
That's right.
No longevity at all.
My, how times have changed.
Yeah, really have. But you see, the sponsors took pride in the programming in those days. Now, there was always the hue and cry. I'll editorialize for a second here.
Good.
Always the hue and cry that once they got the network programming out of the hands of the sponsors, the audiences would have better programming. And eventually, through the 50s and the 60s, the programming moved away from the sponsors who really produced the shows through their advertising agency, or most of them.
You got it.
To the point where now the networks are producing the shows or paying for the shows to be produced, and the sponsors really don't have any interest in it other than the sheer numbers they're getting out there. Whereas in the old days, and you were there with the Jell-O and with the Lucky Strike things, I believe that the audience, in their response to the sponsor, fortified the sponsor and kept his interest in presenting that program.
I think your analysis is very well taken, and I don't think anybody can dispute it.
Did you have any experiences with the audience responding to a sponsor, either positively or negatively, about anything that was on the show?
We never had any difficulty in all the shows that I did, particularly with the Benny operation. There was never that conflict between the show and the client. The sponsor, I think, was very well aware of the fact of Benny's integrity. Mm-hmm. And his great showmanship and his devout attention that he gave to taste that he did on the show. And that was one thing that got Jack a great children's audience.
Mm-hmm.
Because he never tolerated anything on the air that was the least bit off color in those days. And it was a show that the whole family could listen to with no compunctions whatsoever. No fear.
Everybody enjoyed Jack Benny because Jack Benny was so different He was the star of the show, but he was really, he didn't have all that many gag lines.
No, Jack has often said, I'm the biggest straight man in the business. And there was many a time when, well, Jack had a basic philosophy, if I may divert here for a moment, that
certainly,
as I analyze it, and that is, Jack, it was obvious that this was his philosophy. The bigger he could make the supporting people that worked with him on the show, the bigger it made the Jack Benny show, and the bigger it made Jack Benny. Now, this is a leaf that I don't think any other comedian ever took out of Jack's book, and it was so sound and successful that I'm surprised somebody else didn't pick it up, too. But that was Jack. That was the generosity and the thoughtfulness and the great showmanship that was reflected in Jack's operation in all the years he was on the air.
When you read about someone who has written something about the Jack Benny show, they always say he surrounded himself with all the stooges, and he would say Mary and Dennis and Phil and Don and the other ones.
Don't forget Rochester.
Rochester, of course. And yet, if you think about it, really, Jack was the stooge, and all of the others were the couldn't be stooges. You couldn't call him a stooge because Jack, a stooge is the guy who, in my mind, always gets the bad end of the joke or the bad end of the story.
That's right.
And that was always Jack.
But you brought up a reflection there that sparks a memory in my brain right now. There was one show, radio show, many, many years ago that I can recall very vividly that Jack did not speak one word on the show or on a microphone until the last 5 minutes of the show. This was the great generosity of this great man. Other comedians, if in rehearsal a supporting player got the laugh line, the star had that line on the air, not the supporting player. Jack was the reverse. And all but 5 minutes, Jack was not on the air. We talked about him. We kidded him. He sat over with that kind of sheepish expression on his face on a chair to one side. And all the gags bounced off of him, but he never uttered one word, which was an amazing trait, really.
He really knew. He had to have an awful lot of confidence in himself and his whole program.
Certainly he did.
He was a contributing writer, more or less, to the show.
Jack was a great editor. Jack was a creative mind. He created a lot of the basic ideas, just the thought, and turned it over to the writers for development. And, of course, Jack always engaged the greatest writers in the business, in my opinion. And, well, the show just took off from that basic, rather simple formula. Jack was a great blue pencil man. He could tell you from here to doomsday whether or not it was a gag that belonged on the show, that fit the character it was given to, or didn't fit the character. He knew what it was all about.
We're talking to Don Wilson, announcer for 35 years with Jack Benny on radio and television, appearing in the big broadcast of 1944 at the Mill Run Theater in Niles through Sunday, the 15th of June, along with Harry James and the orchestra, Dennis Day, Fran Warren, Warren Covington and the Pied Pipers, Carmen Cavallaro, and the incomparable Hildegard.
It's the greatest show value in town. Don't miss it.
Absolutely.
You'll love yourself for having seen the show.
I said the other day when someone called and asked about the prices for the shows, and I said that this dollar for dollar, you can't get a better, your money's worth better any place else. To see all of that talent is worth twice as much money.
It's not a cheap show to produce. Believe me, it's not. And it's a great value, and sheer entertainment, no messages.
Well, who was it? Eddie Cantor, who said, if you want a message, call Western Union.
That's right.
Did you ever work with Eddie Cantor?
Yes, I did, for 6 weeks. At a time when Ari Von Zell, who's a very close friend of mine over the years, were contemporaries. Harry could not make an Eastern trip with Cantor, and so Eddie asked me if I'd fill in for those 6 weeks. Now, the Benny Show had terminated for the season, and I was at liberty to do that, so I worked straight for Eddie for those 6 weeks.
You were mostly working for Jack Benny, but you were not exclusive to Jack at any time?
Virtually so. I did not have a contract that per se tied me down exclusively, but in its application, it perhaps was an exclusive contract. And that was due to, in the later years, to the fact that Jack's recording sessions or his on-camera TV appearances were not too predictable because he had other things going, particularly mm-hmm. his concerts mm-hmm. with his violin. And so the schedule for the radio shows and the schedule for the TV shows had to be governed ultimately by his availability. So the rest of us made our time available to him. So that excluded me particularly, as I recall, from doing a lot of other shows that were offered because I couldn't guarantee mm-hmm. delivery of myself.
In the 1950s, Jack turned to tape for most of his shows, but prior to that, basically, those were all done live.
In the early days, they were, and then finally for the repeat show, they went to the transcriptions, a 33 mm-hmm. and a third, you mm-hmm. know. We used to do two shows a Sunday, mm-hmm. one for the East Coast and one for the West, virtually. And that was a bit of much. And finally, when transcriptions came along, and we were able to do the show once a day, and then the repeat show mm-hmm. being played off those transcriptions, that was a great boon, really. Great boon. Then, of course, tapes came along later.
Mm. When you did the show twice, if Jack had the 7 o'clock time spot, you were probably doing it at 4 o'clock.
That's
it's
right.
always in the West Coast, in Hollywood. Right. You did it at 4 for the Midwest and the East, and then again at 7 for...
7 was the New York time.
Right. Well, was it heard at 7 in the West Coast
no.
as well?
No. Not as a general rule. The repeat show was.
The repeat, yeah. But when the West Coast heard the Jack Benny show, they heard it at 7 o'clock?
Yes, Pacific Coast time.
Pacific time, right.
Yeah.
But what they were hearing initially was a repeat broadcast and later was the transcription then.
Yes, you can say that.
Yeah. When you had those two live shows, you've obviously had 3 hours worth of time between the shows or 2.5 hours.
But it was well-consumed time mm-hmm. because there was rewrites that went on during that time. Things that Jack and the writers and the producers thought might pay off did not pay off. So those are little changes mm-hmm. that were made. So that when they did the repeat show, it wasn't identical to the show mm-hmm. that we had done earlier.
So maybe the West Coast, when they got the second shot at it, they got a better show than we did here in the Chicago area.
Well, that's altogether possible, I think. You can't argue with that.
I don't think there ever was a bad Jack Benny show.
No, I think your point is well taken. Babe Ruth never hit a home run every time he got to bat either. And I don't think anybody on radio ever hit 100%. But Jack's batting average was extremely high. Believe me, it was high. And I don't say that because I had the privilege of being associated with that great man. It was a fact and well recognized and known in the industry.
Now, you've recently, I don't know how recent it is, but you're a resident of Palm Springs.
That's right.
And how recent is it? When did you take up residency
in
Palm Springs?
Oh, about 12, 13 years ago.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So that's...
We got out of the mm-hmm. Los Angeles rat race, as we call
uh-huh.
it,
uh-huh.
and decided we'd make our home in Palm Springs. And so that's what we've been doing.
Palm Springs was the real or fictional setting for a number of Jack Benny shows each year.
That's right. In the old radio days, we used to go down two or three times a year,
mm-hmm.
and we'd do a show from Palm Springs that related to Palm Springs or the trip to Palm Springs. But it all had something to do with Palm Springs.
The most memorable ones for Jack Benny radio fans is a show he would do first or second week in December from Palm Springs, and it was the Christmas shopping show.
Oh, yeah.
And Jack would go into the department store, and he'd be trying to buy gifts for all the members of the cast, but the whole thing revolved around a gift for Don Wilson.
Shoelaces.
Shoelaces.
The generous man.
Or golf tees.
It could be.
Golf tees or cufflinks.
Yes. crazy
whatever
things
it was.
That happened.
And he'd always go back and exchange because he didn't know whether you'd like cufflinks
right.
with D on it or W or DW or Don. Is your middle name Harlow?
Yes.
Donald Harlow, C D H W.
We had a chap on the show, purportedly our son. Mrs. Wilson and I have no children.
Mm-hmm.
But they hired this chap out of the Pasadena Community Playhouse named Dale White, and he played our son on the show, as Mrs. Wilson played herself my wife on the show for 15 years.
She actually did play herself.
Oh, yes, she did.
Lois?
Lois, that's right. She's the talent in our household, believe me. Well, came from the theater originally.
She did a lot of radio in the 40s, didn't she? Out on the West Coast?
She had been very successful in the theater and looked upon this thing called radio rather down the nozzle, as theater people are prone to do. She said it will never last. It's a single bar medium. The theater, the live theater, is the lasting media. But when the theater stock business kind of went downhill and there wasn't that activity in stock around the country where she had done leads and character parts even as a young girl. And so she got involved through the persuasion of friends she'd been in the theater with, and she got involved in radio and whirled like a dervish ever since.
Do you can you recall some of the things she did that we might recall ourselves?
She was more or less a regular on the Lux Radio Theater, which was the hallmark of great dramatic shows. She played the principal supporting part to the leads that came in from the picture industry for several years. And she probably was on 3 weeks out of every four in a month. She was very popular there. She created the mother role for more kids that grew up in our industry. Corliss Archer, Date with Judy, well, you name it. And Lois had the voice quality that even as a younger woman that permitted her to be able to do mother parts very, very effectively. And, I can't name. She has a list of credits as long as your right arm.
The name she used on radio was?
Lois Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T.
Lois Corbett.
That's her maiden name.
And how long have you been married?
We married in 1950. How about that?
1950.
How
so
lucky
you're celebrating your 30th anniversary this year.
Yes. We were married in June 1950. Say, wait a minute.
Uh-oh.
There's an anniversary coming up, and I'm not home. Maybe I better resign and go back home right now, should I?
You got to go to that Palm Springs department store and buy a gift for her. You, over the years, as the announcer and the foil for Jack, on his shows, more or less played the probably the smartest member of the cast. Dennis was always a little
flaky. He was a naive kid.
Yeah, and Phil was kind of brash and after the gals and even a little tippling a little bit.
That's putting it very politely.
But you always had the brains. You were the one who had all of the answers. And, of course, when you...
When I blew it.
Well, when you put Jack into the corner, then he was ready to fire you again, right?
I recall one instance where I was waxing very erudite on the air and introducing Jack and talking about this particular situation, which I don't recall at the moment. And when I got through, Jack said, "My goodness, Don, I didn't know you knew all that. Where did you learn it?" And I said, "I read it in Dreer Poussin's column." Well, that created a whole new ball of wax. The crazy boo-boos that you make.
And that was not part of the script. That was
that just came out inadvertently. Reminds me of one time Fanny Bryce had been off the air for 2 years. She and Frank Morgan were on together for Maxwell House. Now Fanny is coming back with her own show, the Baby Snook Show. I had a cold, declamatory billboard opening in which I said, "The baby shook snow," and fell apart immediately. And the control room fell apart. We all fell apart and then got a big laugh out of it and started all over again.
Well, I understand that at one point you said, when you were talking for Lucky Strike Cigarettes, with their famous jingle back in the good old days.
Oh, here it comes. I knew you'd bring that up sooner or later.
You said, "Be lucky, go happy."
That's exactly what I said. And that was at the close of a show where we'd been doing a satire on with Barbara Stanley.
Sorry, Wrong Number?
No. It was, what was the name of that show? Very well-known show. And we were doing it with Barbara Stanley, and I was signing the show off from off stage, as a matter of fact. And the closing scene, Jack went over and pulled the bell cord to summon the butler. Well, that caused a blackout because Jack did that pulling of the cord with so much alacrity that the whole ceiling fell down. So that was the blackout of the curtain. And the dust that was blown all around them backstage, as you know, they're a little bit drafty anyway. And a piece of plaster or whatever it was hit me in the eye under my glasses, and I reached for it like this and made the boo-boo that you quoted.
Well,
and that put me in the hospital for weeks.
No kidding.
And Lois got the job as the announcer on the show.
Well, they made something out of that, too, then.
Every time somebody on the show would make a boo-boo, Jack was always quick to capitalize on it.
Were you among the... I know Jack was an innovator in integrating the commercials into the comedy.
Yes, Jack was the integrator
of
that
idea. Yeah. You were part of that with the Jell-O thing, as far back as the beginning.
I didn't do the so-called hard sell announcing on the Benny Show, although that was the job I was hired to do originally. But Jack started having the writers write me into the script. So for a number of years, while I was always referred to as Jack Benny's announcer, even by Jack himself, the serious commercials at the opening and the close of the show were done by other people. Uh-huh. I didn't have anything to do with them. But where I came into was the integrated commercial or the comedy commercial in the middle of the show that we did with the Sportsman's Quartet for so many, many years, so successfully. And that was the part of the commercial that that I really participated in, as well as other characters throughout the show.
Where did the Sportsmen come from? were they a quartet before they were formed for, or were they formed for this, or were they singing before?
No, they were going quartet before Jack hired them, and very successfully too, and made a great reputation for themselves. And it was all built out of a hum. Jack would ask them a question, and in harmony, they would hum, and that was the thing that started their career on the Benny Show.
And they'd start whatever song was popular, and they'd do the normal lyric, and then come back with the
special lyrics
for Lucky Strike Cigarettes.
That's right.
It was absolutely fantastic. It was so terrific. And, of course, you were always bringing in the Sportsmen.
Yeah.
To the show. Don would show up with the Sportsmen.
What a memory you have.
Well, there was one time, I think, when the Sportsmen were missing or were gone, or I think the on-the-air explanation was that their wives all gave birth to children at the same time, and so they had Dick Hames and Bing Crosby, Dennis Day, and Andy Russell come in there.
I forgot all about that. Glad you reminded me of it. Thank you.
a little trip down memory lane. You have you toured with Jack in the United States during World War II to many of the camps. No, but you stayed stateside and went to many of the military camps.
Oh, yes. We were very busy doing that, and we're thankful to be able to do it.
What kind of a reception did you get from the military personnel?
Just absolutely fantastic. They're the greatest audiences you ever want to play to. Great audiences, wherever it was, whether it was a military establishment of any kind, an army base, a navy base, or a hospital, or whatever it was. Those audiences, those kids were great, great audiences. Jack loved to do shows for
the service. You did a lot of work for the Armed Forces Radio Service with their command performance, I think.
Yes, I started the command performance when that was instituted. Then when I went east, Ken Carpenter took over.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I returned, I started mail call.
That's correct. Mail call was...
You're bringing back memories I thought I'd forgotten.
Well, these were
thank you.
These were... You're entirely welcome. I'm pleased to get the memory buds working here. These programs were never heard stateside. They were produced for these large 16-inch transcription discs.
That's right.
To be sent to all over the world.
All over the world. That's exactly right. They were great shows. Every top star in the business was on either mail call or command performance at one time or another, or several times.
And they all worked for nothing, didn't they?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
How
right.
about the writers? Did the writers contribute the material
too?
Oh,
tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
Tremendously. Jack wouldn't do a show without his writers helping him put it together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, they did a lot of work for him.
They were marvelous. Well, you weren't on just with Jack Benny on the command performance or mail call shows. You were on as the... Either the MC or the host or
the announcer
for a galaxy of stars.
That's right.
With those
That's
things.
Right.
Did most of those programs come from that theater on Sunset and Vine where the Lux Radio Theater was brought? Because there was a radio studio.
We did several there, but we did We did several of those shows from a number of different locations, at networks and so on and so forth around town, around Hollywood.
The Armed Forces radio shows often had audiences. Were they mostly military audiences?
At the time we were doing the performance, yes, mostly. There were a certain number of civilians in the shows, of course, whether we were in one of the studios or whether we were on a military base of any kind. But by far, the majority of the audience was military. And the nice thing about it, Jack would come into an auditorium that we might be playing on at a naval base or any military base, and if he found the GIs down in front, he immediately arranged it in his own politic way where they got the brass out of those front rows and the GIs down, because that's where your audience was.
Yeah, yeah. That tells us more about Jack Benny, too, doesn't it?
That's right. That's right.
We're talking with Don Wilson, and I want to know a little bit more about you. Now, everyone associates you with the Jack Benny Show, but you did so many other programs, too. You were involved in the 1930s in a program for Packard Automobiles, weren't you? The Packard Show. Didn't you announce the Packard program?
Well, I started that in Hollywood, and there again, Carpenter, whom I put in the radio business, succeeded me. And he did more of the Packard shows than I did. I started them on the coast and then went east and had to drop off of those, and Carpenter picked up at that time.
How did you start Ken Carpenter in the radio business?
Well, Carpenter had never seen the inside of a radio studio before. He was the son of a minister out of a town in Illinois that's very famous as a beer town.
That's Chicago, Morton Grove,
where they brew a lot of beer. It doesn't come to me at the moment, but it's rather incidental. Anyway, the head of a small agency in Los Angeles came to me one day and he said, "Don, we have a new minister at our church in Glendale. He has a son who wants to get in the radio business. Will you audition him?" And I said, his name was Wilson, too, incidentally, no relative. Mm-hmm. First name, Alan. I said, "Well, Alan, I'll be glad to talk to the young man, but I have no place for anyone." So he sent Ken Carpenter in, and I took a liking to him right from the very beginning. We had a long talk. I gave him an audition. He was a college man. He was a highly dependable individual. You could tell that from talking with him. And I arranged it so I could hire him and put him on the relief shift at the noon hour and the dinner hour to pick up buttons, because we were tied to the network at that time. And that's how Ken started.
To pick up buttons, now, what does that mean?
Well, picking up the buttons means that when you got a station break, the announcers had to push their own button. You had a man in the studio control room, but you had to pick up your own button in order to activate your voice. And you'd give your station call at that time, which was KFI in those days. And that's about all you had to do.
In other words, when the network would take a break for station identification or the music
that's
would
right.
be playing, you'd pick up the button.
So you got it.
You'd turn on the switch and say the call letters of the local
that's
station,
right.
and then
that's
they'd
right.
pick it up again.
That's right.
And for that, they paid you.
Well, that's what Ken Carpenter was hired for. If I may brag a little bit, I was chief of staff at that time. So that's how it all happened.
You really have enjoyed your radio work, haven't you?
Very, very much.
Did you enjoy television as much as radio?
I think so. It's a different medium. It's an entirely different ballgame. And it's gotten so that a lot of the charm that we used to enjoy in the old days has been dissipated. It's a numbers racket these days.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You used to go into a radio studio or in the early days of television and you knew everybody. But I mean everybody. And you knew them intimately. And there was a great rapport. But that's gotten so it doesn't exist any longer. It's like a factory job these days, you know. Maybe you'd see somebody, you've never seen them before or won't ever see them again, but there they are for that specific job.
Radio really was kind of a family association with the people behind the microphones as well as the people
indeed
in front of the receivers.
One of the great things about radio, and it will never be acquired by television because it's impossible. But in the radio days, through the listener's eye, his mind's eye, he lived the show with you. He recreated, as the words came over the loudspeaker, he knew exactly what that individual looked like, although he'd never seen a picture of anybody. Mm-hmm. But in his own mind's eye, he did. And he knew what the situation was that we were talking about. Again, the imagination played the part. And that's one thing that young people, kids today, do not have that advantage that those of us that knew radio in the old days, because their imagination is no longer stimulated as it was during the days of radio.
Well, you helped us stimulate our imaginations with what you contributed to radio. And
well,
for
thank you.
Millions of people out there, I have to say thank you, Don Wilson. That's what, that's really something else. I have to say, too, I spent almost every Sunday at 6 o'clock here in Chicago, sprawled on the floor in front of that Zenith console radio, listening to you and Dennis and Phil and Rochester and Mary and Jack and the whole crew go through the fastest 30 minutes on radio.
It was. Went by like wind, really. Went by so rapidly.
And those programs created some 45 years ago, 40, 30 years ago, are just as funny, just as good today
just
as they ever
were. Just as good today
were.
As the day they were originally written.
Absolutely.
No question about it. That type of comedy we no longer have. And bless the listeners' hearts for making it possible for us to succeed in it. Because without the devotion of the radio listeners and subsequently the TV viewers, without that devotion that the public afforded us, we wouldn't be here today. We are indebted to the public for all the invaluable things that they did for us.
Well, the public is indebted to you and the radio people, too. But they are expressing their gratitude this week at the Mill Run Theater in Niles because they're seeing radio come to life on that revolving stage out there when the big broadcast of 1944 opens each night.
Thank you for mentioning it. You're there with
Dennis Day. And now you and Dennis do a little bit there about
the Benny stuff. We have a little badinage that's reflective of the way Dennis used to work on the show. I, at one point, they've given me a very presumptuous job in that occasion, and that's I'm reading the straight lines that only Benny could do.
So
I hope that anybody here won't think I'm trying to imitate, because I'm not an imitator.
Well, there is no one who could imitate Don Wilson either.
Well, there's nobody that can imitate Jack Benny. Believe me, I'm the first one to know it.
Well, you're in good health. You look very fine and fit. And when we first met, I saw you lighting up a cigarette, and I said, I noticed it was not a Lucky Strike cigarette, and I said, Don Wilson lighting up a cigarette that's not a Lucky Strike, and you told me why.
When they quit sending them, I changed brands.
When the freebies ended, right?
Yeah. It's been a joy talking with you. Thank you very much for having me as your guest. We've gone back over things that are very vague in my memory in some respects, but are pleasant to relate and chat with you about. And I must say you have almost an inexhaustible well of information about particularly the Benny Show, and thank you for revising my, or not revising, but revitalizing my memory.
It's my pleasure.
Many of those days.
Thank you very much, Don Wilson.
Thank you.